Oh, hello and welcome. It's This Is Going Well, I Think, with David Cooper, and I am your host, David Cooper. It's This Is Going Well, I Think, the show where no one's listening. No one cares, the show where every episode's the last episode. Oh my God. Thank you for tuning in, especially after that. We've got a fantabulous lineup for you tonight. We'll go into space, deep space. So far, we'll have left the solar system. NASA sent off a probe many moons ago called Voyager 1, and it has left the heliosphere. It's left the sun's solar wind bubbly thing. And this satellite was supposed to stop working a long time ago, but it's been sending us data back on what interstellar space is like until recently. Garbage. Nonsense. Ones and zeros that should have been zeros and ones. We'll have tech expert Carmi Levy talk about how that's about to change. NASA may actually have a fix for this thing, and how they're going to do it is fascinating. That, of course, and more with our tech expert, Carmi Levy. And after Carmi ceremoniously departs, we'll have someone on to talk about something called a chosen family. That's when your group of friends becomes your family because you've been ostracized, you've moved away, or maybe you just have a small family. Turns out millennials and Gen Z are embracing this concept more and more. Sorry, Gen Z's in Canada. We'll have a cultural historian on named Ainsley Hawthorne to discuss this. So I'm looking forward to getting started. But first, this. Hello, listeners. Let's dive into a story that really puts a new twist on the idea of breakfast in bed. Recently, a 27-year-old man from Tunisia had a real rude awakening when he fractured his penis while sleeping. You're wondering what this has to do with breakfast in bed? He rolled over onto his erection and heard a snap that wasn't from a Rice Krispies commercial. Get it? Snap, crackle, pop, breakfast? Anyone? Anyone? Moving on. Now, this fella had what doctors are calling an eggplant deformity, maybe named after the emoji. And this is no garden variety eggplant because his penis swelled up and turned purple like an eggplant. Let me fill you in case you're wondering. Of all the produce you want your junk to look like, eggplant, not a good one. So you might ask yourself, what do you do after such a startling late night mishap? Well, the man waited 36 hours before heading to the hospital. That is exactly 36 hours more than I would have waited. Talk about procrastination. Makes you wonder if he was trying to figure out how to unsnap, uncrackle, and unpop itself. That was a callback to the breakfast joke that wasn't good. Moving on. Upon arriving to the hospital, the situation was so bent out of shape, the doctors had to perform emergency surgery. They degloved his member, which sounds painful just saying it. And trust me, it's about as unpleasant as it sounds. It's like pulling a rabbit out of a hat, but nobody's applauding at the end of the magic trick. And lying there on the surgery table, doctors found not one, but two fractures. That's right, his penis was double trouble broken. And fixing it up was no small feat, but unfortunately, they managed to stitch him back to his former glory. They gloved him, re-gloved him. He can now wear a glove without hurting. Actually, I don't know that. 4 days later, the man's back in business, having full erectile function restored. There's no long-term damage, and he can still pee straight, and he enjoys his private life, he says. Now, that's a relief, because you wouldn't want your love life to turn into a real flop after such an incident. Get it? Flop? So let's wrap this up. Maybe check how you're rolling in your sleep tonight. Double check. Because you wouldn't want your midnight snack to bite back, if you know what I mean. And by snack, I mean Rice Krispies, and I mean snap, crackle, pop. That joke didn't work the first, second, or third time. Happy eggplants, everybody. Kellogg's Rice Krispies. And now for something completely different. I've been trying to have phone calls with strangers to sort of give this show a little bit of interactivity. And so today I was all set up. I had my number out there. I was going to take calls. And then the door rang. I had coffee with a friend and a bunch of calls went to voicemail. Most of them stupid, but one of them not. The topic I wanted to chat with people about was fungus. Yes, fungus. Tell us a story or an experience you've had involving fungus. That was to be the topic. I say this to celebrate the fact that the tinea on my back has come back in full force. And yes, my girlfriend's been treating it. Is that erotic? It's not meant to be erotic. But back to this call. This one person left me a voicemail, and it's just too good not to play. So here it is, from Stephanie.
Hi, David. I'm Stephanie. Yeah. One peculiar experience I had with fungus occurred in my own backyard, where a small patch of mushrooms unexpectedly sprouted overnight. It was a damp and humid morning, and as I stepped outside to enjoy my morning coffee, I noticed a cluster of mushrooms emerging from the moist soil beneath a tree, right? Now, what struck me as odd was the rapid growth and unusual appearance of these mushrooms. You know, they were unlike any I'd seen before, with caps that pulsated and glistened in the morning light. As I approached for a closer look, I couldn't shake the feeling of unease that washed over me. Curiosity, however, got the better of me, and as I reached out to touch one of them, only to recoil in surprise as it emitted, what was that again? A faint puff of spores into the air. That's how I would describe it. It was as if the fungus was alive, reacting to my presence with a mysterious and almost sentient energy. As I watched in awe, more mushrooms began to emerge from the ground, and it was a surreal sight at the strange phenomenon unfolding before me. After documenting the unusual display, which I can show you with a few quick photographs, I decided to leave the mushrooms undisturbed and let nature take its course. However, the memory of that strange occurrence has lingered with me then, and the mushrooms have disappeared though, leaving me with a new profound respect for the enigmatic world of fungi and its ability to surprise.
I love fungus content. All right, momentarily after the jingle, we are going to have Carmi Levy on to talk tech stories of the day. In particular, Voyager 1 may soon be back online. And also, Carmi's going to share about how the White House is trying to create a time standard for the moon. I'll be right back. And we are here with technology expert, technology communicator, tech man Carmi Levy. He comes all the way from London, the other London, Little London. I call London, England, Big London, and London, Ontario, Canada, Little London.
It's the one that everyone expresses disappointment with when they realize that I don't have that fun accent and I don't live in the Big London, that it's the boring one in Canada that no one ever talks about. And I'm like, it really is a lovely place to live. We do have a Thames River. Most of our streets have the same names as they do in London. We just don't get all the cool shows. And, you know, we just, you know, we're not the center of cultural life in Europe. But, you know, there are other benefits to living in a sleepy town like this one.
I feel like you could visit your friend on the west side of town and then call someone who didn't know much about Canada and be like, yeah, I'm in London. I'm going to the West End tonight, you know, just. And then you could watch a TV show at your friend's house. You say, I'm going to the West End to see a show, you know?
Exactly. And then get home well in time to actually watch the end of the show because you're not sitting in traffic for Lord knows how long. And we don't have congestion fees for our cars. So that's a plus.
But you also don't have the tube, although you could just carry around a tube of something and be like, I'm on the tube. That, okay, this joke is really wasn't good to begin with. And now I'm just nailing the coffin on it. Carmi, some fun stories. The Voyager 1 probe, for those who don't know, NASA shot a probe into space, and it did a loop around Saturn, or maybe it was Jupiter. It took a photo of the Earth that I believe Carl Sagan, I've talked about this on the show before,
Pale blue dot.
Carl Sagan forced the NASA to turn the probe around and take one photograph of the Earth from far away, and it's just a tiny speck of blue light, which is kind of amazing, but the probe was only supposed to do so much, and then it just started shooting out into space, and it stayed online, and it stayed working, and it now is the furthest from the Earth, and really furthest from the solar system, because as I understand it, it's kind of left the solar system, man-made object that's transmitting us data, and we're learning really cool things from it, like what is in interstellar space. Like the sun has kind of a what's called the heliosphere, And that is, I'm not like a science expert, but my understanding is the sun kind of has like an atmosphere. You can think of it like an atmosphere. The sun kind of, with all of its rays and heat and who knows what, it kind of creates a bubble. And that's where the solar system is. And what's beyond these bubbles in interstellar space, we have a pretty good idea of, but we don't 100% know. So this probe is just so interesting to me because it's so far away. It takes several, what is it, hours now to communicate to the thing?
I think 23 hours each way. So you're looking at about 45, 46 hours return. If you send a command to the probe, it'll take upwards of 2 days for it to actually respond and get back to Earth.
And if you were standing on the probe with a really good telescope and you looked at Earth, you would be looking at Earth 23 hours in the past because light only travels at such and such a speed. Radio signals about the same speed or exactly the same speed. And yeah, it's just so amazing to me that a man-made object is that far away telling us about empty space. And unfortunately, it got kicked offline recently. What was happening?
So it started generating gibberish. They knew it was able to receive commands and respond to commands, but it wasn't able to do so in a coherent manner. It was just sending back lines of unintelligible code, and controllers couldn't figure out what to do. Of course, they couldn't actually do any science on the remaining instruments on the probe. So they went into troubleshooting mode. This started last November, and it's been kind of going on like a saga ever since. Until finally, one of the members of the ground team recognized something in the code, that there was a pattern, and it wasn't fully gibberish. There was something in it that sort of tipped them off. Anyway, they've been able to troubleshoot it down to a failed memory module that after 46 odd years, it was launched in 1977. 46 years of flying through the solar system. And then out of the solar system, it hit the heliopause, the kind of the edge where the solar winds give way to whatever it is that is out there beyond the solar system. Now it's officially outside the solar system, and it's been absorbing radiation and all sorts of nasty things in deep space for so long that parts of it are starting to fail. And so not all of the memory, it's equivalent to the RAM, the random access memory that you would have in your laptop. That's the stuff that disappears when you power it off. Not all of it is faulty, only one small bank of it. But now that they figured out that it's a hardware fault, they're trying to figure out exactly which part of the memory has failed so that when they issue new commands, they can figure out how to maybe disable it or work around it or not have whatever commands they send land on that piece of faulty memory. So it's, think about the ultimate technology house call. You cannot go to the side of the desk of this faulty piece of technology. You are issuing commands from 15 billion miles away and waiting 2 days for anything to come back every single time. It is a remarkable example of technology being pushed beyond its limits, beyond anything that its designers could have envisioned when they first launched it 46 years ago, when they first designed it over half a century ago. It's really an awesome little story that just kind of keeps popping up, and we finally seem to be moving in the right direction. Voyager 1 is not quite done yet. They're not ready to give up on her.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that they're going to be able to, well, hopefully be able to either disable that area of memory or work around it or change the program so it ignores that memory module. And they are doing what's calling debugging, which is getting rid of a bug in the code or getting rid of an error in the code from that far away. And with a 23 hour or I guess 46 hour turnaround, for a layperson who's never programmed a computer, which is most people, imagine I gave you a piece of paper with 10 steps of long division, just like a huge number divided by a huge number divided by a huge number. And I told you there was an error in it. Well, you would like find the line where there was an error. You would recalculate it. You'd recalculate this other line, and you could do that really quickly. You could check the output of your fixes almost as instantly. You change a number and redo the division. Imagine every time you change a number or every time you thought of something, you had to wait 46 hours to get the answer, and maybe you need to take 100, 1,000 steps. These people are so smart; they're working with such minimal data, and they're gonna try their best to do it correctly, and they'll probably succeed. And it's just amazing to me. The code on these things are like, it's like 1 billionth the amount of storage, 1 billionth the amount of speed as just your iPhone.
The key fob for your car. probably has more computing power and more capacity than the computers that are on Voyager 1 and its sister ship Voyager 2. And I think that's the miracle of all of this, is that that, you know, for as long as they have, for almost half a century, they have been doing incredible science, literally on the frontiers of the solar system and beyond, using, you know, technology that is incredibly primitive by today's standards. And even as it's failing, they are able to figure out how it's failing, and they're able to, you know, continue the mission in some way. And watching, it's one of the things I love about NASA TV. I love to watch, because you'll see they'll send a camera crew into the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which of course is responsible for managing the mission, and they will follow the mission leads around as they have these meetings, as they're troubleshooting, deciding what codes, what commands to send in what order, and it is so methodical, so incredibly planned, so collaborative. These, you know, and you've got to imagine that some of the best engineering minds in the world are at work on this, and we're learning from this. Even though it's ancient technology, the processes that they are using at NASA, at the Jet Propulsion Lab, to fix Voyager 1 are going to help make better iPhones, better computers, better networks. We're learning from them even half a century later.
It's interesting what the human mind can come up with in terms of technology when it's very constrained what you're working with. You don't have like infinite memory, infinite computer power. You don't have a cloud of computers coming up with AI responses to your prompts, but you just have this extremely simple system that needs to be implemented extremely correctly. I think I phrased that wrong, but very correctly. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing what we can do and what NASA can do given those restraints. And I hope Voyager lives on another, 40, how many years?
It's been 46 so far. They just keep trying to stretch it as much as they can. I think we're getting to end stage. I think at some point, like at one point when they were in their darkest moments a couple of months ago, there were some sort of murmurings that, oh, you know, maybe this is the end. Maybe we should start preparing for it. You started seeing some opinion pieces being published about the end of Voyager 1, what that means. But now there's hope. And so even if it's another year, another 2, 5, whatever the number is, I think they can be proud of what they've accomplished here. And, you know, quite frankly, it'll continue to inform whatever new missions are going up. The Europa Clipper mission is going to be launched later this year on a Falcon Heavy. A lot of those learnings from the Voyager teams are going into these new missions, and hopefully we'll learn more about our solar system neighborhood, all thanks to these, you know, plucky ships that are still chugging away, Lord knows how far away from Earth. I think it's one of the most compelling science stories around. It's one of the reasons I love technology so much, because it isn't just about the hardware. It's about these amazing people who keep it alive longer than they ever planned to. This was only supposed to be a 5-year mission. Here we are. We're almost 10 times that.
I'm just picturing Voyager 1 going deeper and deeper into space and saying, I think I can. I think I can. I think I can. All right, Carmi, we'll be back in just a moment. Stick around.
You got it.
We're here with technology pro, Carmi Levy. I feel like there's a certain branch of science fiction where there's a race to the moon or there's a race to Mars, and it's really about like Russia, China, the United States fighting. You know, it's kind of like in the not so distant future, superpowers are fighting over colonies on the moon, on Mars, within our solar system. And I feel like we're seeing the world's stupidest version of that play out right now in the real world as the White House tells NASA to create a time standard for the moon. Not Eastern time, not Mountain time, not Pacific time, not Greenwich Mean time, I guess moon standard time. Will they do daylight saving offsets? That is to be determined. But Russia and China aren't signing up, or they aren't agreeing. Walk me through the story. Maybe I don't have it 100% correctly.
Yeah, this sounds like the premise for a Hollywood movie. I feel like I should read it like a trailer. You know, in a world where time on the moon is not the same as time on Earth. And that's really what NASA is saying, is they are. NASA has done some studies and they've shown that a clock, if you look at a clock on Earth and you look at a clock on the moon, when you're on the moon, the Earth clock looks like it's losing a little bit of time every day.
Oh, like relativistic effects. Like, kind of, I don't know, people who've been told, I mean, I don't understand the science, but if you shoot off really fast near the speed of light, time travels quicker for you? or slower for you? Like, if I shoot off towards, I don't know, Alpha Centauri or some distant star, and then I shoot back to Earth, I'm going to come back, I'll have aged a couple years, and everyone on Earth will have aged way more.
It's the movie Interstellar all over again.
When they go into the black hole.
Every tick of the beat. Yeah, exactly. And so that philosophy is working. If you're standing on the moon, time seems to be moving slower.
So if I want to live longer, I should go to the moon. Well, I'll live the same amount of time, but everyone else will live less than me.
The radiation will kill you, but you know, the time will seem to move slower. So the neat thing is it's this is not just a moon thing. This is the moon and every celestial body. So depending on where you're standing, on whatever planet, on, you know, near whatever star, whatever it is, that time will feel like it's moving differently. And so the notion of applying Earth-based time, you know, like the universal time code, if you know, Greenwich Mean Time, to space-based time is somewhat naive. And so NASA has been studying this. And now the White House, they have something called the Office of Science and Technology Policy. They have ordered NASA to come up with a plan over the next couple of years. They give them a deadline, end of 2026, to come up with something they call coordinated lunar time, which is basically a new time system so that astronauts and anyone else who travels in space, cosmonauts, taikonauts, depending where they're coming from, that they can use this common form of time that represents the realities of time when you're not on Earth. And so it basically like a new time zone for the solar system. And they're going to call it coordinated lunar time, or LTC, whereas, you know, universal time is UTC here on Earth. And it'll account for on the moon, it's this different. On Mars, it's that different. If you orbit the sun, it's a different one. And I don't know what it'll ultimately look like. That's NASA's job. That's their challenge. They have 2 years to figure it out.
And so China and Russia have decided they don't want to sign up for this stuff?
Yeah, that's kind of the problem here, is that there's something called the Artemis Accords. And this is not the Artemis mission. The Artemis mission is, you know, the U.S. is going back to the moon. Basically, it's the follow-on to Apollo. The Artemis Accords are a global agreement, a pact that 36 countries, including the U.S. and Canada, have signed. And that basically it's a template for how you behave in space and on the moon and on Mars and anywhere else. So if you're going to go into space, the Artemis Accords ensure that we're not going to trash space like we have trashed Earth, bottom line, which sounds amazing, but there are over 200 countries on planet Earth, not 36, so lots of countries haven't signed on. And of course, the two major space powers who we compete against, China and Russia, they're not part of the Artemis Accord. So we're going to come up with this new coordinated lunar time standard, and everyone's going to set their watches by it, maybe have to buy a new watch. But China and Russia are, you know, going to go their own way and not sign on to it. So they'll probably have their own form of calculating time, which, you know, I find kind of weird. You know, I guess maybe you buy a watch that does both, but it remains to be seen if they're going to become part of these accords and join this new initiative.
I feel like we would have been having this conversation, maybe not over Zoom, like 500-600 years ago, about what the laws would be when we hit the high seas and when we explore, you know, like Magellan, all these people hitting the high seas, and then international law. Now we have maritime law, which I think most countries, even ones that hate each other, kind of generally agree on certain rules. I wonder when that'll happen in space.
I sure hope soon, because like if you look at, you know, international law, the laws of the seas, maritime law, look at how often there are disagreements. Look at how often China and Russia, for example, challenge American military flights because they say they're not in international airspace or in international waters when in fact they are. So you already see these politically motivated differences here on Earth. And the sad thing is we're setting ourselves up for exactly the same kind of dispute in space, which means that space is probably going to end up being a polluted wasteland just like the planet is. And we're probably going to have that same kind of, you know, superpower state competition in orbit and beyond as we do here on Earth. And I find that really sad. Here's an opportunity to change the narrative. And yet again, China, Russia, and a few others, in fairness, don't want to play ball.
Until the eight-legged, fire-breathing space arachnids come and attack us, and then we all band together as one.
That's right. Exactly. Hey, we know the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Someone's going to pick up on one of our radio signals, and then when they come snooping in our neighborhood, you know, maybe China and Russia are going to want to become part of the club because we're all going to have to band together to fight the aliens.
Yeah. We haven't found intelligent life here on Earth. What makes you think we're going to find it out there in the cosmos?
Not anytime soon, no. And certainly, I kind of have a funny feeling. I have this dream that aliens discover Earth, they pass us, and then they do a closer analysis and realize that, nah, just not worth their while. They keep going.
Well, there. I just been watching, and the books are good too. The Three Broad Body Problem, and the premise is every spacefaring civilization kind of shuts up because they know if they're really loud, whether it's colonizing, whether it's sending out radio signals, whether it's creating a lot of light, whenever they're loud, other civilizations will see them and they're getting naturally competitive and they'll destroy them. So in order to survive in space, you have to kind of be quiet. And that's the reason we haven't met other aliens. Because when a civilization gets big enough that they're loud, their neighbors then go invade them, you know.
I think that horse may be out of the barn already because for decades now, we've been, you know, Earth has been emitting things, right? So we've been sending out signals. We've been making all sorts of
Yeah, but
electromagnetic noise.
on a
And that's,
galactic scale, decades isn't
yeah.
too bad. Like
Oh, it isn't.
we've only been
Yeah.
loud radio-wise for what, like 100 years, maybe?
Yeah, a little over a century. So yeah, we're just getting started, but those signals are already out there, and yeah, it'll play out not over lifetimes, certainly over it'll play out over a much longer timeline than any of us can even begin to imagine. But it's too late to pull those back. Just like Voyager is out there, and it's not turning itself around anytime soon at all. It's not how it works. Radio signals only go in one direction, and at some point they will bump into something.
Okay,
Thankfully, we won't be around when that happens, because you know I don't want to be here when that happens.
when the aliens invade me, neither. Let's
Yeah.
we got a couple more minutes. This one's kind of interesting to me because what if I told you you'd get what 30% more storage on your phone for free, 30% cheaper,
I'm
you know,
down. Yep.
cloud server plans to store all your data and pornography, whatever it is you store. I'm looking at you, Carmi. That's what you
Yes,
said
you are.
for me.
with an accusatory eye.
I know you don't hoard. You don't. I know you don't hoard petabytes of pornography. But back on point here, Google thinks it has found a way to store images with less space and still have high quality. It's kind of exciting. They're calling it JPEG LI, I believe.
Yeah, JPEG LI. So, I mean, if you take a photo, 9 times out of 10, it's going to use the JPEG format, which is a it's called a lossy. So, essentially, it saves space on your drive because it's compressed, but that comes at the cost of quality. The more you compress a JPEG, of course, the smaller the file gets, and the lower the quality becomes. If you're just looking at it on your smartphone, you don't really realize it, but when you start blowing things up and working on professional images, the limitations of JPEG become clear. So Google has come up with an open source standard that it calls JPEG LI or JPEG Li, and they're saying 30 to 35% better image compression than any other method. But at the same, so the files are only two-thirds the size, but even better, they don't suffer the same loss of quality as they get compressed. So they're putting it out there. They're talking with partners. They're trying to figure out how to add it into the domain so that it becomes a standard. But I mean, think of how often you take a photo or you're out there taking pictures, you get a notification from your phone that you're bumping up against the limit of storage on your phone. You've got to delete things, offload to the cloud, back them up, and then you back them up to a cloud-based service and you start getting nagging messages from that service because you've also maxed your limit out there too. It happens all the time. So imagine if file sizes could get smaller and quality could not take the hit that it takes today. That's a win-win. And I say this as a technologist. I also say this as a photographer because I take pictures in my spare time. And I would love to have a better format that balances storage size and quality. And if Google succeeds in getting everyone else to play ball, this could be the next. It's not a major leap, but it's an interesting sort of update from what we've got today. And it will make a difference on pretty much everyone's phone, everyone's cloud-based service. More photos, higher quality, less space. I am so in.
More pornography. Carmi, thank you as always for your time. I just want to make a special service announcement. All pornography comments were made by me. Carmi is not, as we know, a porn hoarder.
Yeah, my I am not, but my wife will be speaking with you later just to settle, you know, settle the score.
I don't know why you come here when I do this to you, but I'm glad you do. Carmi, thank you for being here.
Appreciate it so much, David. Thanks.
Okay, all right, okay. Coming up next, it's chosen family and why so many millennials and Gen Zs are finding family where their friends are. And And I am here to talk about the cousin deficit and why chosen family is very important to millennials and Gen Zs, or as we call them in Canada, Gen Zs. I have here someone who's written on the matter, Ainsley Hawthorne. She's a cultural historian and author who lives in St. John's, Canada. Ainsley, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So it's a really interesting piece you wrote. You started off talking a little bit about your family and then kind of related it to something called the chosen family. Do you want to tell me a little bit about your rather large family?
Yes. So, you know, it was all based on a piece of research that was published in PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, talking about how the number of living family members that people around the world have is declining over time, and particularly the number of people's cousins, first cousins, are declining around the world over time. That's something that we've really seen in my family personally, because I come from a Catholic family with a line of very hardy women who had incredibly large families. So my paternal grandparents had 14 or 15 kids,
wow,
and almost all of those kids had a dozen or more children. So my father had around 140 first cousins.
I don't mean to play into stereotypes here, but wow. Like, I mean, they say this about Catholic families, and I guess it's true.
Yes. I think it probably differs in different parts of the world.
Sure.
We were in a relatively rural part of the world where people were still sort of following the traditional guidelines about no protection, having as many children as God wants you to have. And my female ancestors, I guess, had the physical ability to bear that many children, which not everyone has. And so the result was this huge, huge number of children in my father's generation. And then when you get down to my generation, people were using birth control, were doing family planning. So I only have 11 cousins.
And televisions. Televisions were invented so that you could just lay in bed and do something else.
People are totally distracted. Yeah, it's true what they say. Don't have a television in the bedroom. But no, I have 11 cousins, and my biological niece and nephew will probably have fewer still. They might have 5 or 6. And this is very closely mapped onto the trend that's going on around the world, where in 1950, the average 35-year-old Canadian woman would have had around 20 cousins. Today, a woman the same age has an average of 10. And 70 years from now, they're predicting the average woman that age will have 5 cousins. So it's really, at this point in time, having about every 70 years.
So with the decline of your actual extended family, there's this concept of chosen family. So people don't feel like they're community-less. What is that? Where is that coming from? I hear that a lot.
Yeah, so the concept of chosen family was really popularized in the queer community. It was coined by an author named Kath Weston in a 1991 book called The Families We Choose. And the reason that chosen family was so important to and remains important to queer and trans people is because they have so often, unfortunately, experienced rejection from their families of origin. And so they have historically made very, very close friendships and close relationships with people in their own community, with friends, people the same age in the queer community. And they provided each other with the types of social supports people traditionally got from relatives. So caring for each other, taking care of each other during the AIDS crisis, being available to each other for emotional support, for health support, for concrete forms of support. This concept of chosen family has become increasingly popular outside of the queer community as well. So as people's numbers of relatives decline, and also as we tend to move away from
yes.
our families of origin, right?
Yes.
Because it's not just that we have fewer relatives, but most of us in our culture move for work. You know, we'll move to get the job we want. And as a result, we might not live close to our siblings. We might not live close to our parents. So even if we have family, we're not in the same community to drop by the house with a delivery of groceries when our sibling has the flu, to loan somebody, you know, something like a steam cleaner if we have one and they don't. The types of things that you would typically do for a family member we're just not close enough to do for each other anymore.
You know, it's interesting to me that you mention migration and queer community. I lived next to the Castro neighborhood in San Francisco for about 10 years, which was kind of a hub for LGBTQ people in the U.S. for many years. It was sort of like the center. You could go, you could be gay at a time where it was, you were getting kicked out of your family, kicked out of your community, ostracized. Also a hub for young tech workers to leave their hometowns to go strike gold and work in that industry, whatever negative stereotypes that industry has. So it's sort of these two communities from the U.S. moving there and creating this notion of chosen family. And I myself was one of these people. And so I really felt that. I really lived it, having left a fairly close-knit Jewish community in Toronto where I hung out with my cousins and my family and this and that, to a city where I didn't know anyone and didn't have that support. Now, I didn't have kids, but my friends who did found their, you know, chosen family were the ones who babysat, were the ones who helped out with the family in a way that other families traditionally did. Is this a completely new thing, or have we seen these patterns in Western culture for a while now?
It's not new, because even if you think about, you know, how family traditionally works, you're always choosing family members. Like if you choose a romantic partner, if you adopt a child, there are certain family members that you're raised by or raised with, and then family members that you bring in later on. So there's always a certain portion of the family that is chosen. But I think what we're seeing is, because of these patterns where people have fewer living relatives and they're not in proximity to those living relatives, creating family-like structures that are mostly or entirely friends is becoming more important than it ever was historically when families were bigger. And like you say, it's not just for people with kids. It can be very important for people with children because of childcare, and because that is such a huge amount of work if you don't have siblings or grandparents nearby. It's very helpful to have friends who can pitch in. But it's also for, you know, adults who don't have children. I don't have children, and it's really important for me to have these close friends and to be providing each other with emotional, physical, and different types of support.
I mean, the desire, the need for a sense of community, I think, is something that unites us all, very different and very similar. How do these chosen family structures mirror traditional biological family structures, and how do they differ?
Yeah, so I think what we see is a lot of similar types of support that people traditionally got from their relatives. So part of that is emotional support, but other types of concrete supports, like I mentioned, dropping off groceries when you're sick, taking you to an appointment if you have like a medical appointment, or loaning you things, helping you with household projects, teaching each other skills, which is something that traditionally were passed down in families. Now a lot of skill sharing goes on in chosen families. Somebody, you know, knows carpentry, and so they'll help out with a carpentry project and teach a friend those skills. And you can also have sort of, for example, part of my chosen family, the chosen family that's local to me, are 11 friends, and we all know each other. So we all get together for family dinners. We're all on a group chat together. We all keep up with each other. And we wind up having sometimes these like domino effects of support because we're all in one group. So friend A recently had to have a very stressful medical procedure. So she asked friend B to come with her to the stressful medical procedure. Friend B has a 5-month-old baby. So friend B asks my spouse to look after the baby while she's going with friend A to the medical procedure. And this works because we all know each other. We're all part of the same, you know, little family. And so we're all kind of participating in this system of care. It's like a circle of care where we're all helping each other out in those ways that we need, very practical ways that are normally the type of level of participation that you would only see from people who are related to each other through kinship.
Got it. So last question. I'm a loser. I'm deeply unlikable. And I have moved to the biggest, loneliest city in the U.S. and Canada, New York. What advice would you have for someone like me, or anyone who's moved to a new place or has shifting family dynamic where they might want to build their chosen family? What should they consider?
Well, do you know what? I love that you said that, because I have moved around a lot over the years, and I was always a person who didn't have many friends. So everywhere I moved, I had, say, two really close friends. And then I would move somewhere else and have to start all over again and maybe make two really close friends. And it's only in the past, say, 5 or 6 years since I've settled in my current city that I've made a larger group of friends. And I would say doing that as an adult really takes a concerted effort. Like, you have to make the decision to stop, you know, you sort of say to people offhand, let's go out to lunch sometime. You never really do it. So it takes the concerted effort of actually following up with someone. I really meant that. How are you Tuesday, April 29th? Like, that would be great. Let's go out. Let's get closer to each other. So making sort of an effort to make friends, going to places or events or groups where you'll have things in common with people, you're more likely to meet people that are kind of on the same wavelength or have the same values as you. That could be like a community group. It could be, you know, hobby group, something where you share something in common with other people and you're more likely to be able to build friendships based on things that you share in common. I would say in my case, strangely, the pandemic really helped to solidify our friend group, which is maybe the opposite of what many people experienced during the pandemic, which was isolating for so many people. But we were sort of becoming good friends before the pandemic, and the particular guidelines, safety guidelines where we were, wound up encouraging us to spend more time together. Because at first in our community, the suggestion was bubble with one other household. So one other household you could not be socially distanced with. And eventually they extended that to up to 20 people. And all of us in our little friend group, we made those 20 people our biological relatives and then this group of 11 friends. So we spent the rest of the pandemic spending time with each other. We were the people who were allowed to, like, not socially distance. So we went to parties, we did stuff together. So strangely, the pandemic in my case helped us bond very closely, which isn't necessarily everyone's experience.
Got it. So I don't have to create a new global pandemic to make friends. I'm just picturing
lots of ways to do it.
I'm picturing my mom saying, to have a friend, you have to be a friend. Anyway, Ainsley, thanks for coming here and talking to me about this.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure to be here.
Ainsley Hawthorne, she's a cultural historian, author who lives in St. John's, Canada. You can find her writings on this subject in CBC. The article's called The Cousin Deficit is Why Chosen Family is So Important to Millennials and Gen Z. And a hip-a-da-hop, and a hip-a-da-hop-hop-hop. Thank you for tuning in. I'll see you tomorrow. Snap, crackle, pop.